What is good, ladies and gentlemen? We made it. We're at the weekend. And when you guys lay back to kick it with a couple of cocktails this weekend, I'm laying down 72 hours of badass podcasts coming your way this weekend. I can't wait to get it started today. I have such an awesome lineup over the next 3 days. I'm so stoked. I hope you guys hang with me all weekend. First and foremost, I want to remind you that my patrons, my listeners, the people that sign up for my Patreon are the people that keep this podcast going. This podcast doesn't happen. I'm self-funding everything, okay, folks? As President Trump would say, we are keeping this podcast going just on listener donations, and I want to shout out some of my patrons real quick before we get started because they're the people that make podcasts like today's happen. First and foremost, my friends over at the Sang Lucci Steam Room, Sang Lucci and the crew, these guys are some of the original gangsters of following options flow, following the money, market psychology. They have a fantastic room that tracks money flowing in and out of options to help try to give you an edge on where the money is moving and where equities could be heading, because oftentimes the equities do follow the money in options. Right now, they're also offering something called the 3LT Playbook, and there's a link in my podcast description. The 3LT Playbook is Lucci pretty much laying out the three principles that turned him into the seven-figure trader that he is today. And the best part about this dude is he's no bullshit. You're going to get honesty. Like today, I was just on his Twitter. He said, turned my plus $200,000 week into a plus $50,000 week. It's still more stacks than I'm moving. But my man's not afraid to admit when he takes a loss like he's done on the podcast. And I've known him for 7-8 years. I'm proud to call him a friend. Check out the Sang Lucci Steam Room. The link is in the podcast description. Also, this podcast is brought to you by The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a brand new online trading service that offers investor advocacy. It offers investor education. It offers daily watch lists. It offers live streams of trading all day. So you're going to get ideas. You're going to get a little bit of everything. And the guy running the whole show, my buddy Pete, who I've befriended over the last month, as I generally befriend people who donate to the podcast, wink, wink. No, Pete's a good guy. He started the Trader's Path because he got sick and tired of the normal Jason Bond, Tim Sykes type trading programs. So this guy wanted to be more real. He was tired of these programs. He thought he was getting taken advantage of. So he wanted to go out and he wanted to create an investor advocacy and investor education program that was for the little guy. And as I was telling somebody today, when I bring people on Patreon or whatever to sponsor the podcast or to become donators, as I call it, and shout them out at the beginning of the podcast, they have to pass my bullshit test. And Pete passed that with flying colors, which is why I'm happy to announce that also he's offering, you can sign up for like $29 now. He's offering a brand new premium just for my podcast subscribers, though. So make sure you use the link in my podcast description. You get the first month for like $29. Check it out. If it sucks, you don't like it, what are you out? $29, maybe even talk to Pete. He'll probably refund you. He's a nice guy. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends at Rumorhound. Rumorhound is an extremely innovative piece of AI software that is going to help you guys sort through mergers and acquisitions rumors that you see every day on Twitter, on chat rooms. It's going to look at the source of the rumors. It's going to look at the possibility that the transaction can happen. It's going to look at all the different variables that go into a rumor and is going to generate to you, using artificial intelligence, whether or not a rumor has credibility. So you can decide then, as a trader, whether or not you think it's something worth pursuing or something worth leaving alone. Personally, I've always had a problem with these. I always get them wrong, which is why I like Rumorhound, because it keeps things very no-nonsense and makes it very easy for me to try to decide which rumors I want to pay attention to and which ones I should probably just leave. So check out my friends over at rumorhound.ai. Their link is also in the podcast description. So for your convenience, folks, you're looking for something? You're looking for something on the guest? You're looking for a way to throw me some money? You're looking for a way to visit one of my awesome patrons? Check out the podcast description. It's all right there. Before we get started too, I want to shout out some of my retail patrons, the little guys that keep things up and running here, and some of my newest patrons. Lisa Hyatt just checked in. I just shot you an email like 5 minutes ago. Robert Young, Roy Nessessian, I appreciate you, brother. Steven Clark still here. Ben Morris, Bird Necessities. I shouted you out yesterday. I think I shot you an email. James Mullen, Macro McGuffin. What's going on, my brother? Shayevitz is in the house. Gary Wozniak's here. Noah Weichert, Stephen Pickens, Matthew, and my homeboy Avi Geller. All you guys, thank you for checking in. And some patrons that have been with me for a long time, like Austin Clark, Wolfgang Pippinger. I appreciate you. Rob Lippich is still here. The Death of Rats is still in the house. Robert Razagitis, whatever. You're still here. Happy to have you here, brother. Post Plastic Surgery Balance Sheet still in the house. Coyote Blog still here. Blue A Parker still here. Harrison still here. My friends at Corvus Gold are still here. How about my friends Chris Bede, Ken R., Chris Boas, Nathan Michaud over at Investors Underground. Appreciate you guys helping out. And Piggly Wiggly, can't forget you either, my kind friend. All right. And finally, one more addition. Sorry, we're going to get started in 1 second. Thank you guys so much to those who have signed up for the GoFundMe. The point of the GoFundMe account, as you know, Dave Collum, my interview with him, has been banned from YouTube. I don't know why. If we find out today's interview has been banned from YouTube, we'll know maybe it has something to do with questioning the official 9/11 narrative. We won't know until then. YouTube won't give me a reason that it's been banned, but I have started a GoFundMe account, the purpose of which is to be able to put infrastructure in place so that I can continue to provide podcasts without having to rely on social media, and also to take the podcast and turn it into a five-day-a-week thing. So a Monday through Friday endeavor. If you feel like you're not getting enough content, check out the GoFundMe. It is a it's a lofty goal that I have to reach. I might not get there anytime soon, but I think over time we can get there. And when the free market tells me it's time to pay attention and time to do shit on my own and time to do the podcast Monday through Friday, that is exactly what I'm going to do. Two more rules before I introduce our guest today. First is I do recommend a 2-drink minimum for this podcast, as I always do. And for this podcast, I am not a financial advisor. None of this is obviously financial advice. And I'm also going to qualify, I'm not a civil engineer, and I have really no clue why I'm talking about. This is why I am so stoked to have our guest on today. Prompted by my discussion that I had a couple days ago with Mr. Collum, I reached out to Richard Gage, and if you don't know who Richard Gage is, he's a 30-year San Francisco Bay Area architect and member of the American Institute of Architects. He's the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Mr. Gage became interested in researching the destruction of the World Trade Center high-rises after hearing the conclusions of a reluctant 9/11 researcher, David Ray Griffin, on the radio in 2006, and this kind of launched Richard's quest for trying to seek the truth about 9/11. So AE 9/11 Truth now numbers more than 3,000 architects and engineers, not 3,000 random people, 3,000 people who are professional architects and engineers. And what they're seeking is a new investigation into the destruction of all three World Trade Center high-rise buildings on 9/11. So as an architect, Mr. Gage has worked on most types of buildings, construction, including numerous fireproof steel frame buildings. Most recently, he worked on the construction documents for a $400 million mixed-use urban project with 1.2 million square feet of retail, parking structure, and mid-rise office space, all together with about 1,200 tons of steel framing. And I'll just add before I introduce Richard, the reason I wanted to bring Richard on the podcast is because as far as seeking a new investigation into 9/11, I'm familiar with his work, and I find him to be one of the most measured and calculated and reasonable people with serious expertise on the matter. And, you know, Mr. Gage and his group, they're not some crackpot group of individuals that are claiming, you know, that there's no evidence that planes flew into the towers. And they're not claiming it was an orchestrated New World Order. All they're seeking is a new investigation because of some of the facts that they have uncovered that don't sit well with them. So I don't want to say anything else because I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I would like to welcome Mr. Richard Gage, AIA. How are you, sir?
Thank you, Chris. I'm doing really great, and it's an honor to be on your show.
Yeah, it's really awesome to have you here. We were just talking a moment ago. I can't believe that you don't get more interview requests and that you were so quick to get back to me and appear on the show.
Well, we have done about 600 interviews over the 12 years, but I will not turn down an interview request. So some days I wait for them, and I was just delighted to have yours come in.
Yeah, I think one of the bigger ones that you've gotten, which I think people can obviously familiarize themselves with your work. There's an immense amount of stuff of yours on YouTube, but your appearance on C-SPAN was really one of the larger interviews that got on national television that I thought was fantastic when it happened, and I thought that you did a great job there. So I would encourage.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would encourage people to look that up. I want to start.
Well, wait.
Go ahead.
Since you mentioned C-SPAN, I mean, there's an extraordinary fact here that most people don't know, and C-SPAN has a show called Washington Journal where they interview all the senators and congresspersons and notable people in Washington D.C. and we had hassled them for a year to cover Building 7 and AE 9/11 Truth's 3,000 architects and engineer petition signers, and finally they called us and said, okay, what do you got? Well, that video became the number one watched video on their entire website with over a million views, and so more than Obama and other interviews they've had. So we're just delighted to see that happen. But we haven't been invited back, and it's been about 3 years now.
Well, so the first thing that I want to do, I'm not surprised that you haven't gotten invited back, because sometimes people, they just, you know, there's a lot of comfort in accepting the mainstream narrative to anything, and it's difficult to sometimes jar people loose from that. Right up front, what I want to do is I just want to establish a couple of your credentials. You have a BA in architecture from USC, and you're a member of the American Institute of Architects. And I was hoping that you could just tell my listeners about that organization and anything else credential wise that I kind of missed in your introduction.
Well, I'm a member of one of 80,000 members of the American Institute of Architects, which is a private association of architects. So they do a great job marketing to the world the AIA after your name. Essentially, it means you're a licensed architect and in good standing with continuing education credits and so forth. So I have been trying to educate the other members of the AIA for 12 years now, right? Going to conferences, bringing the evidence that we're going to be talking about today in evidence booths, if you will, doing presentations where we can to architects, private firms even, and bringing a resolution to the floor of their annual business meeting 3 years in a row to try to get them to support a new investigation into the destruction of the three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11. And we have not succeeded in that. It takes a lot to open the minds of people, and specifically organizations like this.
So in terms of where I want to start the discussion, I wanted to be a little selfish and kind of talk about Building 7 first, if it's okay with you, for just a couple reasons, and then I'm going to let you just go. The first reason that I still find out today, 20 years later, is that there is a large faction of people that don't know a third building fell on 9/11. And the other reason is, as I personally try to remember the events of the day of 9/11. I was 18 years old and I was in my college dormitory at the time. And we spent the majority of the day watching the news as the events were unfolding. And I was in Pennsylvania, Richard. So, you know, at one point there was a plane that was over Pennsylvania. Nobody really knew where it was. So we were paying very close attention. And as I try to recall what that was like for me that day and the feelings that I had and the things that I remember, the one thing that I remember, and the key that has always kind of kept me interested in a new investigation is the idea that I distinctly remember people on the news that day who knew that Building 7 was going to come down, who were saying that, you know, keep your eyes on the building, it's going to be coming down at some point. And to me, it always felt like it was an assumed the collapse of 7 was going to happen before it happened. So I was hoping you'd talk some about Building 7 first.
Yeah, let's start with the facts of the building. But now, this as you mentioned, this is the third worst structural failure in modern history. And yet most people, in fact, most architects and engineers know nothing about it. And it's absolutely extraordinary when we go to the conferences and show the video of this building's collapse. And they go, oh, a controlled demolition. When did that happen? And we're going, well, as a matter of fact, this happened at 5:20 in the afternoon of 9/11. 7 hours after the Twin Towers are destroyed, this building, after witnesses hear explosions, it drops like a rock straight down uniformly, symmetrically into its own footprint in under 7 seconds. A 47-story skyscraper drops at free fall acceleration, as fast as you can drop a bowling ball off the top of this skyscraper. That's how fast it came down. Now, that's the facts that nobody disputes. So what do we do with those facts? Well, first we look at the witnesses that hear explosions before the collapse, and we've got those on our documentary, 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. You can go to the YouTube and just Google Building 7 or search Experts Speak Out, and the one-hour version of our DVD comes up, and it shows this building dropping symmetrically. Now, how do you have a building drop like that? Well, the official story blames fire. But fires have never brought down a skyscraper before 9/11. And there's been dozens and dozens of examples of skyscrapers with much larger, longer lasting, and hotter fires in them that have never collapsed. They're just remodeled, put back into use, because that's the nature of steel. It doesn't even soften fireproofed steel in skyscrapers like we have today. The fire can't get to it. There's fireproofing there, 2 and 3 hour fireproofing. But there's only enough fire in a given area in any of these buildings to last 20 or 30 minutes. And even NIST acknowledges that. NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress to explain these three collapses to the American people. And how did they explain this one? Normal office fires. And they did that in a 1,000-page document that they hoped people would never read, because it came out 7 years after this building collapsed. So we have a lot of problems with the document, with the timing there. We have many, many challenges in different forms to the official narrative of this building's collapse. But we look further and we find evidence, forensic scientific evidence, in the debris of thermite, an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. This comes in the form of hot molten iron, temperatures exceeding, documented by OSHA and Bechtel and firefighters and others, exceeding what the hottest office fires can even get to, by a factor of 3 or 4 times hotter. Well, where do those temperatures come from? In fact, the satellite imagery by NASA's thermal imaging shows over Building 7, or at Building 7, 1,300 to 1400 degree Fahrenheit temperatures on the surface of this pile a week after 9/11. And so wait a minute. Fires, typical office fires, are only 500 or 600 degrees. Now, even jet fuel doesn't even burn that hot. And remember, according to the manufacturers of jet fuel, and remember, no plane hit this building. This building just dropped. It did have some beams that hit it from when the towers went down. But NIST acknowledges that this is an insignificant factor in the building's collapse. They fault a hot office fire, which they previously admitted could only last 30 minutes, but they say it lasted for 4 hours in the northeast area, because that's the area where underneath the East Penthouse, which collapses first. But then they have this whole elaborate computer modeling scenario with input data that they will not release. When we asked for that with a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act, they said they denied it, saying, oh, we can't give you this information. It would jeopardize public safety. Well, wait a minute. The architects and engineers are the people that are responsible for ensuring the public safety. We have to have this information so we can suitably evaluate and analyze how this building came down and if NIST's work is correct. And there's so many holes in it. In fact, we've hired the University of Alaska, Leroy Halsey, one of the top forensic structural engineers in the country, the chairman of the civil engineering department there, to conduct a 3-year, $300,000 finite element analysis, the study which NIST was charged with doing by Congress, but which failed miserably, which we can get into. But this new study proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that office fires could never have brought down this building. And they're showing what could have. By gosh, if you cut all 82 columns in this building at once, guess what? The model shows that it comes down exactly like the videos showing that it came down, which again, your listeners can just go to YouTube and Google Building 7 Collapse, and they'll see how it came down. I mean, it's an extraordinary story, and sorry for hogging the air here, but I get excited about telling the aspects of this building's mysterious collapse and the cover-up which ensued to keep it silent.
Well, that's why I've had you on. So hog away, number one. What I told Bernadette, your assistant, when I was talking to her a couple days ago and trying to get you booked for the podcast was, you know, I had recalled the same story I just recalled now, which was watching Fox News at around 5 in the afternoon. And I recall it with some clarity. And again, going back to this feeling I had that there was an expectation that that building was going to come down. It kind of, I don't know if it was witness testimony, not testimony, but witness interviews of people that, I remember there was a firefighter who said that building's going to be coming down soon, whatever. And so what actually got me to look into 7 originally, to be honest with you, was when I found out that the government or NIST had claimed that it was an office fire that brought the building down, because it was years later, and that didn't gel with how I remembered it. I remembered it as coming down on purpose, you know, as coming down to try to, you know, because the structural integrity maybe had been compromised or for whatever reason they had given. So as you say, the cover up to me was always the thing that kept me very curious.
Yeah, and the cover up did not happen until day 2. Because many people did see Building 7 coming down who were watching TV that day. And they actually announced the collapse of this building, in fact, just 20 minutes before it even happened on BBC. I'm not kidding you. Jane Stanley is giving a live report, and she announces the collapse of this third building, and they even give the reason on the station: due to structural weakening when the twin towers came down. But there, right behind her shoulder, is Building 7 still standing. It doesn't come down for 20 minutes. So they knew, but weren't saying, that the building was going to come down. They, in fact, the firefighters were told not to fight the fires. At about noon, they were evaluating the fires, but they were pulled out. And they, and Larry Silverstein, the owner of Building 7 and the Twin Towers, well, the builder of Building 7, he became the owner of the Twin Towers and the other World Trade Center building complex in a very shady deal that took place just 6 weeks prior to 9/11. So, and then he secured the most incredible terrorist insurance ever secured on any building. And he walked away from his $125 million personal investment with the ownership of the site and a $5.68 billion payout by insurance companies. So this is needs to be looked into as well, of course. But we also have in the litany of evidence other foreknowledge, because these one firefighter, well, he was a his name was Kevin McPaddock, a former Air Force medic, and was on site. He was moved back along with others behind a line set up.
And I remember that.
He says he's listening to a radio held in the hands of a Red Cross worker, and he hears 3, 2, 1. And then he heard the ground shaking, you know, 6 blocks away from Building 7. And he looks up and he sees the building coming down. And there's other witnesses of explosions, including Michael Hess and his deputy of the housing department, Barry Jennings, who were witnesses of explosions inside the building because they had gone back into Building 7. Not realizing that it had been evacuated at first after the planes hit the towers, but before the towers came down, and they're experiencing all these explosions inside the building, including the stairwell they were walking on, which blew them back up into the 8th floor, they said, Barry Jennings says. And then he says they're walking across dead bodies in the lobby of Building 7. This was before the towers collapsed. Their rescue was before the towers collapsed. Actually, that's not true. The towers collapsed while they were stuck in the building, and then their rescue was after the towers collapsed, but their experience of explosion was before. So this is an amazing set of stories, and we can't find out too much more from him because he died under very mysterious conditions the day before the final report came out on Building 7 by NIST, 7 years after the collapse of this building. So there's all kinds of foreknowledge. They're told, well, it has structural damage. So some people heard they're going to have to bring it down. There's those kind of quotes, hearing the fire department talk about this. Well, fire departments don't bring down buildings. And you don't bring down a building by controlled demolition in the afternoon because it might be some hazard.
Right.
It takes months of engineering, planning, and placing of specific shaped cutter charges, thousands of them throughout the columns and beams in the building, and set them off in a very precise order so that they look exactly like, for instance, the old hotels in Las Vegas. Controlled demolitions. That's exactly what it looks like when you play them side by side, as we do in our documentary.
So if you're new to kind of thinking about alternate theories about 9/11, or even just, you know, I want to keep it as off the crazy conspiratorial spectrum as possible and stick to kind of these basic common sense reasons that one might want to not even say, hey, something crazy happened here, but just push for a new investigation, right? And when you talk about what, you know, so first off, maybe you didn't know there was a third building that came down. If you didn't, maybe that's worth looking into on your own to get started. For me personally, always have found Building 7 has kind of been the key where you can crack the door a little bit and let a little bit of sunlight in and start to look at these things like you're talking about, where, you know, firefighters do say we're going to have to bring it down, or that building's going to be coming down soon. But let's, I also just want to unpack one other thing you just said there, because we kind of breezed over it. And to me, this was one of the key pieces for thinking, why would they do that, right? And that is the BBC interview. All right, this woman is live on BBC. She's standing in front of a window, and over her shoulder, you can see Building 7, as you just said. So it clearly hasn't been brought down yet, or it clearly hasn't collapsed yet. And she's reading on live television that the Solomon Brothers building, Building 7, has collapsed due to structural weakness, which means she got that message ahead of it happening. Now, I'm not gonna extrapolate that into anything, you know, but I just think if you're looking for common sense reasons to think about 9/11 in a different way, or at least push for a new investigation, right? Maybe NIST's, you know, maybe NIST's narrative somehow turns out to be true and we just don't know how they arrived at their conclusions. But isn't a new investigation owed just based on common sense type facts like you're talking about like that?
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot more common sense. That morning at about 11:07, it was reported that 15 minutes earlier on CNN, they heard from a firefighter, or they said they did, that a 50-story building went down. Well, that's the second example of foreknowledge here, which you couldn't possibly know. It's unprecedented that a steel frame skyscraper could come down by fire. It's never happened before 9/11 ever. And yet here they're saying a 50-story building went down. There was dust and debris everywhere, canyons filled with smoke. This is in the morning, which is about, by the way, 20 minutes after the Twin Towers had come down. Actually, a half hour or so. So had the Building 7 come down at that time, and there's no other, by the way, there's no other 50-story building that came down. There's no other buildings that came down. You know, there were some buildings that were severely damaged by the debris when the towers came down. But this is a very specific report of something that hadn't happened until 7 hours later. So had it come down, though, we would never have any videos of it, because it would have, at that time, been completely covered by the massive dust cloud released when the Twin Towers came down. So leading some to suspect that that it may have been supposed to have come down at that time, and didn't. And that the reasons these mysterious construction workers, also caught on CNN camera, hearing an explosion over their shoulder, looking back at Building 7, and then looking straight into the CNN camera and saying, that building's about to come down. The building's right. about to explode. Right. Flame and debris coming down. Well, how would they know that? And who were these guys walking away from the building? Were they in it that morning or that late, that early afternoon, late morning, fixing a dud of a controlled demolition that was supposed to go off but didn't? That's a possibility that researchers are looking into. But it adds to what you're talking about. It makes your hairs stand up and want to look into this a little deeper. But more specifically, scientists and physicists are wondering, how did 400 structural steel connections fail every second in this building? In other words, all at once. That's what has to happen for a building to fall symmetrically at free fall acceleration, right into its own footprint. I mean, the center of this pile is in the center of the building. So architects and engineers, now numbering 3,150, are demanding a new investigation. And let me tell you, these are not conspiracy theorists. These are skeptics who looked at the information, had the courage to look at the evidence,
right,
and then to call publicly, take a stance, a public stance on calling for a new investigation, because this building went straight down through the path of what should have been the greatest resistance,
right,
the 40,000 tons of structural steel that was 3 to 5 times stronger than it needed to be to keep this building up for its life. And all of a sudden, where did all that strength go in less than a quarter of a second? It's gone. 82 columns have been cut, at least on 8 floors, because that's the amount of distance, 100 feet, or a third of this building's 7-second fall, that physicists have clocked it going down at free fall acceleration. And this is acknowledged in writing in NIST's final report, but they don't acknowledge the implications of that free fall acceleration, that that structure all of a sudden disappeared.
And the interesting thing, just to go back to what you're talking about, these 3,000 architects and engineers who kind of have the courage to ask these questions, you know, a big problem with asking for a new investigation on 9/11 or alternate theories on, you know, 9/11. And I think one of the few advantages from moving further away from the incident is that it tugs slightly less on emotional heartstrings now, because it was a very emotional day where a lot of people lost their lives. And, you know, as you kind of moved away from the event, the closer you were to the event, the more there was this attitude that if you were going to question the official narrative, you were somehow denigrating those who lost their lives, or you're somehow denigrating the first responders. You know, I was just watching this Senate testimony that John Stewart gave in defense of providing funding for these first responders, and I couldn't agree with him more. I mean, these people are absolute heroes, and the people that lost their lives on 9/11 should never be forgotten, and we should never forget what a horrifying incident it was. I think, as I said, the one advantage of moving a little bit further away from it is I think people are more likely to look at it with an air of realism and a little bit of skepticism, and a little bit less emotion. And I don't think that that's, you know, I'm not saying that that's a great thing. I think we should kind of always remember exactly how emotional of a day it was for a multitude of reasons. But I think the idea of being able to look at it through a little bit more of a skeptical lens and try to address the facts here, Richard, without talking about the emotion behind it, I think actually helps out a little bit.
And that's easier with Building 7, because what we're told is nobody died in this building. Now, that is contradicted by one of the witnesses, as I mentioned. But that's why I start with Building 7, because it opens the architects, the engineers' minds, even media professionals, and even representatives in government whom we've gone to now at least 6 or 7 times and provided them our DVDs, provided them our petition, provided them the Bobby McElvain Act for a new investigation, which is draft legislation calling for a new investigation that we're just trying to get introduced into the House or Senate with a select committee. And that's why we're going back in September to Congress armed with Fire Commissioner Christopher Gioia, who has succeeded in yesterday, actually, getting 5 other fire commissioners on the board there at the Franklin Square and Munson Fire District to come out and call for a new investigation. They're calling for this support in this resolution, which was passed yesterday, supporting the U.S. attorney's promise to impanel a federal grand jury investigation using the evidence that AE 9/11 Truth has put together over the last 12 years. So that's a huge set of exciting developments. So we'll be at the National Press Club in the morning or afternoon of September 11th with the fire commissioner, calling for a new investigation and then taking that over to Congress with specific meetings with specific elected representatives. And what we're going to be telling them is not the conspiracy stuff. We're going to be telling them what FEMA found. FEMA did the original investigation before NIST. And in their Appendix C, they report high temperature corrosion attack on the steel, sulfur, and molten iron penetrating into the steel. The author of that report declaring that the ends of the steel beams were partly evaporated in extraordinarily high temperatures. Well, it takes 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit to evaporate steel. That's more than four times how hot most office fires ever get. And these office fires, by the way, were few, small, and scattered. They were not the kind of office fires that were told by NIST, and the photographs prove that. And in fact, the photographs prove that the fires were out on the area of the floor over an hour before the collapse of this building, the area of the floor that NIST claims is the initiation of the collapse of this building, where they say these long span beams of 50 feet heated up over hours and then finally pushed this girder off of its seat because they thermally expanded, causing floor 13 to fall on 12 and 12 on 11 and so on for nine floors, leaving column 79 unbraced. And then it just buckles because it doesn't have the support. That's their whole theory. And none of it could have happened. I mean, it is all fudged. And we go over this in our detailed examination of that. Not the least of which is the fires were out in that area. They couldn't have been thermally expanding that beam. The beams were fireproofed. They couldn't have expanded even if the fire was there. And it couldn't have pushed the girder off of its seat because it didn't have the expansion length wired, given even the hottest temperatures, because it would have sagged instead of expanded before it could push that girder off of its seat. All these things Leroy Halsey, professor from University of Alaska, has already proven. So we'll be releasing that at the press conference also in September, along with providing the update on the FBI lawsuit that our attorneys at the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry have filed against the FBI, charging them with negligently omitting the evidence, key evidence, that Congress required of them in the 2015 9/11 Commission Review Report. So that they had our evidence, they had our DVD, they even commented that it was backed by thorough research and analysis back in 2009. So that paper, which, by the way, is one another extraordinary piece of forensic evidence here that we haven't touched on yet, but that 25-page peer-reviewed paper by a team of eight scientists was given to the FBI, and they didn't forward it either, as they were legally required to do, to Congress, which would make it essentially public record.
And which paper was that? I lost you there for a second. What was that paper?
Yeah, this is one of the key pieces of evidence, because all of the samples collected independently by this team of scientists from all over the world, led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen, they find in all their samples these curious red-gray chips. They look like paint. They're red on one side, gray on the other. So they were fluid applied. Largest one's about 16th of an inch long, and they do detailed analysis, zoom in with an electron microscope. They find the elements of thermite in it, actually nanothermite, because these iron oxide and aluminum elements, particles, are actually smaller, the 1,000 times smaller than a diameter of a human hair. They found that they're set in an organic bed of oxygen, silica, carbon. So this is organic material is what makes TNT so powerful. It expands, producing an explosion that knocks things over.
Can you just, so Richard, can you just give the listeners an idea of what it's like to find nanothermite from a chemical makeup standpoint there? And like, what's the likelihood of that chemical makeup being found within the debris just kind of randomly? Maybe some guy was working on a science project somewhere in the building. You know, how rare or ubiquitous would it be to kind of find this stuff in everyday materials?
By extrapolation, we're talking about 10 tons of unignited nano thermite. This material, when they put it in a heater, a differential scanning calorimeter, it ignites, producing previously molten iron microspheres. So this is very specific materials made only in the most advanced defense contracting laboratories. You're not going to find it in all the dust samples unless it was a part of bringing the towers down. 10 tons of this material is what it amounts to. Now, these previously molten iron microspheres are the result of the ignition, because they have molten, they have iron, which is the key ingredient of thermite, and they also have aluminum, which is released in aluminum oxide as a gas in thermitic ignition. So this material is should not be found at all, much less in these incredible quantities. But it also proves what was the previously molten iron microspheres that the U.S. Geological Survey documented in all of their samples, studies of the World Trade Center dust. The World Trade Center dust has up to 6% of its contents in many of the samples is actually composed of these iron microspheres. Well, iron is the byproduct of thermite, as we mentioned, but they have no idea where they came from. They couldn't even begin to speculate, and they didn't. So they just document them very carefully. How much? Up to 10 tons of this material as well is by extrapolation. It's so ubiquitous in all the World Trade Center dust that it they call it a signature element of the dust, signature component. It's not even World Trade Center dust unless it has these previously molten iron microspheres. Most of them are naked to the human eye. Many of them are big. Well, how did they get there? Well, it's proven by just experiments in your own backyard. You ignite a thermite and it releases hundreds and thousands of these molten iron microspheres. Well, that's exactly what the nanothermite dust did in the laboratory at Brigham Young University. So this is all documented in a peer-reviewed paper in the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal, which is a 25-page peer-reviewed paper that came out in 2009, I believe, or 2007. I got to get that date right. But it's extraordinary evidence, and it's been overlooked by the official community, that swept under the rug in this cover-up of the crime of the century.
So you have this substance that really, in terms of identifying it, is extraordinarily unique, right? It can't be mistaken for something else, this nanothermite. And it's an incendiary, right? Which means that, you know, it's made specifically for the purpose, or it goes up in flames extraordinarily quickly and burns at an extraordinarily high temperature.
It's designed to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. It's its original purpose.
So, I mean, that in and of itself, finding it there, and you're saying there's no real conventional use for this thermite. So outside of what you think are defense applications, this stuff doesn't really exist. Guys aren't, you know, ordering this for their at-home science projects.
There's thermite and there's nanothermite. Thermite has been used for more than 100 years on railway lines to weld them together. Train rails. So the nanothermite is quite unique, developed only just prior to 9/11 by Lawrence Livermore, developed by Lawrence Livermore Laboratory and also at Los Alamos Lab. It's made only in the most advanced defense contracting firms.
Yeah, so it's not something you can just find or just, you know, order from somewhere. So it's really, truly an anomaly to find it in the rubble.
Of course.
So one of the things I want to go back to that you said prior, and I want to probably about 20 minutes ago, but I'm just diligently taking notes here. when we started to talk about Building 7, one of the things that you said was it was the third largest steel frame building to come down from fire, okay? And I'm assuming the first two were the Twin Towers. Is that correct or no?
Yes. No high rises have collapsed before 9/11. And the first two in history were the Twin Towers that morning.
So, again, just going back to trying to apply these tiny little common sense, like, aha, you know, that now, obviously, planes flew into the buildings, right? So for people that aren't physicists, people that aren't familiar with the chemistry behind it, the things that we're talking about, we're going a little bit deeper on, they say to themselves, all right, a plane hits a building collapses, that makes sense, right? But then you throw seven into the equation, and now we're asking people to accept that the three largest steel frame buildings in history all came down on the same day from the same cause. And I thought that would be an interesting dovetail into talking about the main towers themselves, because, you know, Richard, I want to know kind of how you explain what you take issue with the main towers to somebody that doesn't understand physics, sees the planes fly into the building, and to them it makes sense that buildings would collapse there, because they see the top floors, you know, maybe pancaking the ones below it, and to them it makes sense. How do you start there, and what do you take exception with when it comes to the main Twin Towers?
Yeah, let's slow it down first. Even the official story acknowledges that the planes hit the towers. It was an hour to an hour and a half later that the towers came down. In fact, NIST even acknowledges that 90% of the jet fuel burned up outside the building. The rest of it was gone in 10 minutes. And so for an hour and a half or so later, we have normal office fires. It was simply ignited by the jet fuel. So these are pretty normal office fires, in essence, especially when you look at the time of the collapse of these buildings. The fires were quite diminished, and the thick black smoke indicating oxygen-starved fires. So this is quite important to acknowledge. You know, there was some damage to the columns, but the official story says, nevertheless, that at the point of jet plane impacts, the upper part, say in the North Tower, 15 stories above the point of jet plane impacts, I'm getting a lot of background noise, which is distracting on your end. So if you can help me with that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So the upper part of the tower, they say, after fires caused the sagging of floor trusses that pulled in perimeter columns, causing their buckling, allowing the upper floors to drive the rest of the building down to the ground, this big section of building, like a pile driver, all the way down to the ground, and then destroyed itself. Now, that came out 2 days after 9/11 by Zdenek Bessant, a structural engineer from Chicago Northwestern University. 2 days, he provides this detailed theoretical thesis about how these towers came down, which became the official support for the NIST theory, which is what they call the column failure theory. Essentially the same thing, and essentially a pancaking collapse. But guess what? You can't have the lightest part of a structure destroy the heavier, cold, hard, intact steel all the way down to the ground and then destroy itself somehow. It can't work like that. There's a law of physics. There's an equal and opposite force of destruction operating here. When a Mack truck, for instance, runs into a Volkswagen, it's the Volkswagen that's destroyed, you know, even before the engine of the Mack truck is even touched. So this is what we're talking about. A quarter inch, 3/8 inch steel at the very top versus solid 52 inch by 22 inch steel at the very bottom, and a virtual pyramid of steel these things were. So that's extraordinary. They violate the laws of physics they're right off the bat. But then, in addition, the upper part is in fact destroyed. Watch any of the videos. It's destroyed in 4 seconds. After that, there's nothing left to drive the rest of the building down. The question is, what's destroying it? Well, 156 first responders are on record, orally recorded, talking about sounds of explosions before the towers ever collapsed. They're talking about seeing explosions, hearing explosions, and inside the buildings at various levels where they were, experiencing those explosions there and in the lobby and even in the basement, many witnesses. So we have all these explosions going off, and this is also documented, quite lots and lots of them, even seeing flashes of light. In our documentary, 9/11 Explosive Evidence, experts speak out. And then it's after 4 seconds, they hear more explosions, and then the material shot out, producing freely flying structural steel sections weighing 4 and 8 tons, ejected uniformly, symmetrically out of the sides of these towers, clocked by physicists at 80 miles an hour, landing 600 feet in every direction. They're shot out laterally. Gravity works down, not out. So these are clocked by physicists, also showing that it takes more energy for these things to be shot out than it takes a 200 pound cannonball to be shot 3 miles. So this is an incredible amount of energy that's completely unaccounted for in the official story, as is the lack of concrete at the bottom. We had 110 floors in each of these towers, each an acre in size, and we'd be looking for, in a pancaking collapse, those pancakes. You know, we might settle, okay, maybe there are 50 of them, maybe 20, maybe 5, but we don't even see one of these floors stacked up at the bottom. Where did they go? The bottom of the pile shows twisted steel, you know, 2-3 stories. Where's all the concrete? 90,000 tons of concrete has been pulverized to a fine powder in the mid-air before any of this develops its gravitational potential energy and crashes at the bottom, breaking it up there. No, we don't see it there. It's drifting over a 3-square-mile area, powdered concrete, 100 microns average particle size, documented by the U.S. Geological Survey, from river to river across lower Manhattan, 4-inch-thick blanket of powder. It looks like ash. 30% of it is documented as being concrete. Now, if that concrete was supposed to be the weight of that concrete crushing the building, how can it crush the building if it's distributed all of it outside the building's perimeter, 3-square-mile area? Same with the steel. If the steel's supposed to be crushing the building, how can it be? Because it's distributed outside the perimeter of this building, completely beyond the boundaries of ground zero. So what's crushing the building? That's 2/3 the weight of this building, is the steel and the concrete. There's nothing left to crush the building at all. And that's not what we see. All the photos, all the videos don't show a collapsing structure driving it down. It looks more like a volcanic eruption with freely flying structural steel sections, a geometry of fireworks. By the way, trailing these structural sections are thick white smoke clouds. Well, guess what? Structural steel sections are not flammable. Why are they on fire? That gives credence, massive credence, also to the forensic evidence of nanothermite found in all of the World Trade Center dust samples. So that's why we have 3,150 architects and engineers screaming at the top of our voices, and the 5 fire commissioners now elected representatives of 30,000 people in the New York area demanding a new investigation.
So they found the nanothermite in all 3 of the building's rubbles?
The nanothermite was found across the complete area of World Trade Center 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and from river to river in the dust sample. Some of it was collected on the Brooklyn Bridge itself, samples which contained nanothermite.
It's interesting too when you talk about things like the jet fuel burning up when it hit the, you know, when it hit the building. I mean, for people that aren't, I have a very limited background, but some background working with fuels. And so I understand, you know, the basics. I understand flash points. I understand, you know, how different types of fuels burn, what temperature most types of fuels can burn. Can you just explain to the person that may not have that background about the fires themselves? Talk about how much fuel burn up when the planes hit the building, and then talk about the types of fuel and the temperatures that you would need to compromise steel versus the temperatures of the fires that took place at, you know, after the plane had crashed into the building.
Well, one important fact is that ME Petroleum, who makes jet fuel, says it burns at only 600 degrees Fahrenheit in open air. So it's not contributing anything more than that. And yet we have evidence of molten steel and molten iron, for instance, pouring out of the South Tower just 10 minutes prior to its collapse.
What temperature is that? For the listeners, what temperature do you need for molten steel?
Yeah, steel and iron melt at about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 5 to 6 times more temperature than kerosene, which is what the jet fuel is, can get to, and 3 to 4 times hotter than any normal office fire. So there's no accounting for these extreme temperatures documented by FEMA in the steel, where they say hot sulfur corrosion attack on the steel. So that's... Sorry.
Are you there?
I had a interruption there. So they... hold on a second.
No problem. No problem. I'll use this to take a swig of my drink.
I had to unplug my device there.
Here's a question. Say you have jet fuel and it's burning at 600 Fahrenheit, right? How long do you need to hold something at 600 Fahrenheit up to a steel beam in order to compromise it? I mean,
you could hold it there forever and it'll never compromise it. Steel can get softened at about 1200 degrees. And so the official story acknowledges that the office fires were, well, they claim the office fires were 1800 degrees without any evidence to support that. In fact, the only evidence they have is temperatures of about 500 or to 600 degrees. But even if fires, and there are the hottest office fires that can get hotter than 1200 degrees, which is the reason we put fireproofing on our steel steel frame skyscrapers, so they don't get that hot. But NIST says, well, in this case, it's the jet plane impacts that knocked the fireproofing off of these lightweight steel trusses, allowing them to be more vulnerable. So we say, okay, the steel trusses might have sagged, but they couldn't have pulled in the perimeter columns in doing so. There's not enough force. In fact, in this computer model, they force those perimeter exterior columns to fail by applying a 5,000 pound lateral load on every one of them all at once, so they could force the building to fail. This is complete fraud. Sagging floor trusses can't cause perimeter columns to fail, but the perimeter columns did fail. So how did they fail? Well, FEMA, before NIST, acknowledges that the antenna started falling first, not the perimeter columns. And they're absolutely correct, but NIST overruled that, rewrote the story. Well, if the antenna did fall, what's the antenna sitting on? It's sitting on the hat truss. What's the hat truss sitting on? It's sitting on the core columns. So that proves that the core columns failed first, and that's FEMA's original hypothesis. But that would mean what failed the core columns? Well, there was a couple of them that were hit by planes, but they all didn't fail at once to bring that antenna down before the rest of the building a few seconds. No, So they must have been compromised by something else. And that's why we turn to the forensic evidence of a nanothermite, which explains the whole thing, including molten iron pouring out of the South Tower, the first responders, structural engineers, finding rivers flowing like lava of molten steel. They've never seen this before. They can't explain it. It's unexplainable by office fires. Again, 3 to 4 times the temperatures required to melt steel. Even the World Trade Center structural engineer himself, Leslie Robertson, he documents a river of steel flowing. Well, is he a credible witness? Why aren't we listening to all these firefighters and structural engineers and iron workers talking about all these examples of steel melting all over the place? It's unaccountable in the official story.
It's interesting, too, because, you know, Dave Collum, who's the Cornell professor of chemistry I had on 2 episodes ago, the exception that he first pointed out with the official story and what he said to me was, you know, chaos theory says that, you know, these 3 buildings aren't going to fall straight down, all 3 of them falling the exact same way. And he says you don't need to be a physicist to understand that. And when you're talking about the core columns, you know, what I'd like to give people some insight on, and really by me doing it, I mean you do it, is how many core columns were there, number one? Number two, how many were compromised by the planes impacting the buildings? And number three, wouldn't that mean that the buildings, and this is what Dave Collum is talking about, wouldn't the buildings then kind of slope over? Wouldn't the top, you know, be more inclined to fall to one side? Wouldn't the top just fall off the building, you know, instead of falling straight down? Can you kind of expound on that a little?
Sure. Buildings that fail due to natural causes are not uniform. That's a quote from one of our physicists. You can't have a uniform descent without destroying all columns at once, and not just the core columns, because that would have left the perimeter standing. You got 47 core columns and 287 perimeter columns. You have a massive quantity of steel here that's 5 times stronger than it needs to be to support this building. So they're trying to tell us that the jet plane impacts and the fires caused the uniform, nearly symmetrical destruction of this building in 12 seconds, where each of all of the beams are shattered and severed one from another, one beam from another column, completely shattered, which, by the way, is evidence of high-order damage or explosions, according to the guide 921 from the National Fire Protection Association, the guide for fire and explosion investigation, says look for this kind of evidence. Well, we have the complete shattering of the steel structure of each of the twin towers all the way down to the bottom. You don't have chunks of building laying like you'd see in a natural collapse whatsoever. You have the complete destruction, and in the process you have high velocity ejections of building materials below the zone that where they're freely flying out of, below, 20 stories below, 40 stories below, 60 stories below. You have these high velocity ejections called squibs in the controlled demolition industry that are seen going off that have no apparent reason for going off 60 stories below that zone of destruction. And this says, well, these must be puffs of air produced by that pile driver up above. But we saw in all the videos, that pile driver doesn't even exist. And these aren't puffs of air. These are solid building materials, often at the center of the building facade in an engineered pattern. So, no, these are squibs that are going off probably mistimed too early.
So I guess one of the other questions I wanted to ask you about the Twin Towers and not about 7. I wanted to ask you if there's ever been a controlled demolition that started, like, that was like a top-down controlled demolition. You understand what I'm asking? instead of a bottom first controlled demolition.
In fact, NIST put out this years later after their report. They put out this curious document called Frequently Asked Questions. Very frequently, like, did you look for thermite? Did you look for evidence of explosions and residues of explosions? Which they said, finally admitting, we didn't look for explosives or residues of explosives after claiming they never found any. That's completely insincere at best.
Right.
Ask that question again, because I think I went on to answer a different question.
No, I mean, and that's a great point. That you know, for them to come out and say that they never found any, and then, oh, well, we didn't look for any. Those are two different answers. And that it's those kinds of inconsistencies, just going back to 7, with this feeling like everybody knew it was going to come down, and then all of a sudden we're presented with this cover-up story. It's those kind of inconsistencies are the things that make you kind of turn back and just want to ask more questions. My question was, has there ever been a top-down controlled demolition?
Oh, yeah. Yes, because NIST also said in that frequently asked set of questions, was it a controlled demolition? They sure look like controlled demolitions. When NIST says no, it couldn't have been a controlled demolition because it didn't start at the top. It didn't start at the bottom in the case of the Twin Towers. There are plenty of examples of top-down controlled demolitions. We provide one in our webinar series, 9/11 An Architect's Guide. And we also have it, I believe, in the documentary Experts Speak Out. So it's Control Demolition Inc., CDI, whose CEO, Mark Loiseau, says you can start anywhere you want. You can start at the top. You just take out all the columns under the first couple of stories, and then sequentially underneath that, and you can have a top-down controlled demolition. They're actually a little trickier because they can start to go sideways on you, but they do that sometimes. And what the key is to get the complete rapid onset of destruction, which we see in all three of these towers, by taking out all the columns at once on one or two floors, sequentially timed half a second later or so underneath. And so that's why you have 12 seconds, each of these towers completely destroyed from the top down, or from the point of jet plane impacts down. You have enough mass up there above the point of jet plane impacts to help you do a lot of the crushing. And that's what's explained by Mark Loiseau. And in fact, the rate of acceleration in each of the twin towers is about 2/3 of free fall. That means the building is accelerating faster and faster and faster straight down through the path of what should have been the greatest resistance, the 80,000 tons of cold hard steel beneath the point of jet plane impacts, and yet it falls as if it weren't even there. It's not decelerating anything. It's being removed. It's been removed.
Yeah, is there a good, and I was trying to think of one as you were explaining that, is there a good analogy to explain to people that don't understand what you're talking about when it comes to free fall, when it comes to the idea of the top of the building falling down without any resistance underneath it? I mean, the point you're trying to make is that in a normal situation, the rest of the building underneath where the plane had hit would ostensibly slow down or alter the path of the top of the building as it collapsed. Is there like an analogy that you can provide to somebody that's unfamiliar with the physics, somebody that doesn't have that type of background to kind of understand exactly the point you're trying to make here?
Yeah, it's not that difficult. You drop a bowling ball off the Twin Towers. How fast is it going to fall? It's going to fall at free fall acceleration. It's because it has no resistance underneath it other than air, which is negligible. And so how can a building which has 80,000 tons of resistance underneath the point of jet plane impacts, in this case, fall almost as fast, accelerating, getting faster and faster? Acceleration means the velocity is increasing with distance, so it's accelerating. In the case of free fall, it's accelerating. I forget the number, but it's the acceleration is actually, the speed is not uniform. It's getting faster and faster. So in the case of Building 7, it falls as fast as a bowling ball. While it's supposed to be crushing, in that case, 35,000 tons of structural steel below it. Well, 40,000 altogether. So it can't do both. It can't fall. The bowling ball can't fall at free fall and do any other work because it's converted all of its gravitational potential energy into motion. And that's what Building 7 did. So it fails to account for the buckling of any of the 82 columns in that Building 7. And same thing almost for the Twin Towers. It's accelerating. It's not decelerating. So it fails to account for the buckling of 90% of those columns in the case of the Twin Towers.
So that's, I mean, to me, that makes a lot more sense the way that you just explained it. And I hope that gives the listeners a little bit more of an idea. So if you have time, I have just three more questions for you. Do you have time to take three more? I know that you're...
Sure.
Okay, awesome.
You bet.
So these first two questions are kind of... I've watched your stuff for a long time come from me directly because I didn't really think that I would be reaching out and actually getting a chance to speak to you. So as somebody that's followed your work, I have two personal questions of my own, two of the more curious things that I've looked at involving 9/11 that I always wondered if you had looked at. I don't see you opine on them in your YouTube videos, at least nothing that I've caught. And the first one is... Has AE 9/11 looked at the incident at the Pentagon?
Right. I've certainly looked at it. The Pentagon is that issue of what did destroy the Pentagon is an issue of a whole lot of controversy in the 9/11 truth movement, and the evidence is. Much of it seems to me self-contradictory too. In other words, there seems to be evidence that certainly not clear scientifically to the largest segments of the 9/11 truth movement. And so what we all agree on though is that nothing should have hit the Pentagon. This is the most highly defended building in the world, equipped with surface-to-air missiles, right? And so an hour before the Pentagon was hit, we knew the country was under attack.
Right.
So anything coming toward the Pentagon or the White House or the Capitol Hill would be subject to surface-to-air missiles. And what does it do? This plane that is said to have hit the Pentagon, does it go straight down into Donald Rumsfeld's office, the easiest target, you know, through the roof? No. It flies around the Pentagon in 270 degrees all the way around it, descending 3,000 feet per minute, flying at an outrageous speed, which it probably couldn't even be controlled, a standard airliner, and flies where? Into the office, the accounting office, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which was auditing the Pentagon, looking for the $2.3 trillion that Donald Rumsfeld had announced the day before 9/11 that was missing and they couldn't account for in the Pentagon budget. So a fascinating set of facts there that should provoke a lot of researchers to determine very specifically. And there's a group of them. One is David Chandler and others who support the theory that a large plane hit the Pentagon, but not necessarily the civilian aircraft that they say it did. Another group by Barbara Honegger leading that group says there were explosions and that destroyed that area and a smaller plane damaged outside. And yet another group that says there was no plane whatsoever, that if there was a plane, Some of them say it flew over the Pentagon, not into it. So we don't enter the fray of that controversy because the science is so disputed by all of us in the 9/11 truth movement, or most of us. but we all want a real investigation.
So is it bothersome to you that there has been no video evidence of a plane hitting the building? Indistinguishable. The one thing that keeps coming up with the Pentagon, and again, I'm not an advocate for, you know, one of those theories over another. That, you know, with the Pentagon, the one thing that has always just kind of made me wonder, as Colm actually said on my podcast two episodes ago, is why don't we have a video? Why don't we have a video where in the frame you see, hey, this is a commercial jetliner. You know, this is an American Airlines commercial jet, easily identified. We have all these conflicting reports. People say it was a Gulfstream, you know, business style aircraft. People say, yes, it was a commercial airliner, flew right over our heads. I mean, is it bothersome to you that in an area like that, that, you know, 20 years later, Richard, we don't have a frame of video. We don't have one frame of video, okay, from the Pentagon.
It's completely bothersome to all of us in the 9/11 truth movement that the Pentagon is hiding high-res videos, which they surely have these cameras all around the Pentagon in the most highly defended building in the world, that they haven't or won't release it. And so, yeah, we all are calling for the release of those videos. The videos that they did release show only a few frames of doctored and unclear evidence.
Doctored. Interesting word there. So you're familiar with the difference in the one frame between the two cameras of the video that we have seen. Is that correct?
I've seen some of the videos, yes.
Interesting. All right, so let's move on. We'll leave that as it is. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about before I kind of ask you, you know, what should people do going forward and what's on your agenda going forward? The last thing, just from a personal standpoint, I wanted to ask you about was the cell phone calls from the planes before, you know, after they had been hijacked. I always found this to be an interesting area of the story that I couldn't really find too much information in one direction or another on. And I don't even know if you're familiar with what I'm talking about, but, you know, there were calls made from the airliners, from people that were on the airliners to their loved ones, telling them, hey, the plane has been hijacked, or, you know, various calls telling people that they love them. If you don't see me again, whatever. And I was wondering if you had ever looked into that, if you're familiar with that, if you, you know, can confirm first off that they were made from cell phones and not from airphones, because there are two differences there. And then, you know, what your thoughts are on that, if you have any.
Yeah, all of us have looked into that. I've spent my time focusing on the World Trade Center, so I don't have the expertise or even a good frame of reference with which to explain it. But I would clearly refer people to David Ray Griffin's work on the cell phones, basically, and others. I think Mr. Koenig did some work on this too, where he flew up in planes testing phones, and they don't work up that high. So how was that done? Well, there are several theories out there. I don't support any of them in particular, but one of them suggests that the planes were grounded, and that perhaps under the auspices of an emergency, the cell phones were made from the ground, because in terms of one of these recipients of these calls, he doesn't quite get it, and one of them says, "You believe me, don't you, Mom?" So there's a lot of evidence to suggest that this was all rigged. Exactly how, I don't know.
Yeah, and you don't need to be an expert. All you need to have done is flown on an airplane. I fly all the time. Okay, it's 20 years later. Richard. It's 20 years later right now, and you still can't make phone calls from, you can't make phone calls with your cell phone from up in the air, you know?
Yeah, they disappear about before you even get to 10,000 feet.
Right, right, exactly. Everybody knows that, you know, on takeoff and then on approach, you get to a certain point where you get that first bar that clicks in, and you get bing, 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 all your messages from when you were up in the air. But when you're at cruising altitude, and certainly we're talking 20 years ago, okay?
Yeah.
We're talking 20 years ago, so technology's evolved since then. So I'll leave that there, and I just want to ask you one more question before I let you go. And that is, let's just tell me about like what recent breakthroughs you guys have had and kind of what listeners can do going forward if they're interested in kind of exploring this more. The interesting thing is this movement that you've been heading up has been going now for, you know, 15 years almost. And, you know, the further we move away from 9/11, the more likely it is that, you know, it might fade from people's memory, or that, you know, hey, maybe they watched your documentary 6-7 years ago and they kind of put it down and thought, you know, well, the AE 9/11 movement really isn't really getting anywhere. So what new ground are you breaking? I mean, you guys are still at it right now. And what can people do going forward if they're interested?
Yeah, there's a bunch of new developments. We're gaining traction. First of all, if you ask people on the street, the percentage is going way up about 9/11 being an inside operation, the towers being controlled, demolitions. I think up to 30% of the people on average are aware of that. And yeah, they're like you implied, they're not really doing much about it. I mean, after so many years, but I think something's going to break. Well, first of all, we've had a few breaks. Yesterday, as I mentioned, you got five commissioners in New York demanding a new investigation. This has never happened before. These are elected commissioners in the Long Island area of New York. They're coming with us to meet personally with Congress. They're coming to attend our press conference on September 11th, in which we will also introduce Professor Leroy Halsey and the release of the World Trade Center study, which has been 3 years in the making. So that's going to thousands, 25,000 academic engineering and architecture professors and professionals. And we are, will be releasing an important video on that, and giving people ways to reach their local architecture and engineering professors. We think that'll turn upside down the engineering community out there. So that's going to be huge, coming out early September. We also have, we will have a response by then from the FBI about the lawsuit, which I indicated earlier, as they've withheld evidence from Congress. We've got them by the short hairs. There's nothing they can do. They had this evidence. They have to acknowledge it. They have to amend their report, give it to Congress. That's huge. We also have the promise of the U.S. attorney in Manhattan to impanel a special grand jury to investigate this evidence that we talked about today. And we expect to be called as expert witnesses. So these are all huge developments, and we're very optimistic.
And going forward, if, you know, people that are listening now, they want to look into it further, what's the best way to do it?
Well, first, stay on our mailing list. Go to ae911truth.org and find out what's going on, and subscribe to the mailing list so you get our every other week or so. We send out more sometimes an email letting you know what the latest breakthroughs are and how we're doing. That's real important. So ae911truth.org, subscribe to the mailing list, sign the petition demanding a new investigation. That'll also get you on our mailing list. We have 20,000 others supporting the 3,000 architects and engineers. Take the Bobby McIlvain Act card, which is available on our website. You'll find it right there when you go to the front page on the slide is justice. That's the Bobby McIlvain Act. Take that card to, along with the evidence, the Beyond Misinformation booklet and the DVD. Take them, and there's a 15-minute DVD narrated by Ed Asner just on Building 7. Take those to your congressperson. I get them to introduce the legislation so that we can get a real investigation. It starts with places like this. It's not a popular subject yet,
right?
But it will be when these other issues break, and all of this will be working together cohesively.
Well, and this is, you know, one of the things I kept thinking about, I don't know if you're familiar with Joe Rogan's podcast, one of the things I kept thinking about was, you know, he's got a huge viewership, and it's, you know, tens of millions of people, and he's always batting around conspiracy theories. He's had Alex Jones on, and all these people that don't do, you know, alternate theories for 9/11 any justice. They're more harm than good, you know, as opposed to a person like yourself, who's obviously an expert, who obviously knows the subject material, who's speaking on behalf of 3,000 architects and engineers, people from Ivy League institutions, people with, you know, PhDs, serious credentials. It's your argument that the world needs to hear. We need to hear less, you know, we need less Alex Jones type conspiracy bullshit on 9/11, and we need more calculated, scientific, well-delivered facts. So, you know, I think if these things start to go your way, and I presume that they will, because I've seen nothing that has said to me that, you know, you have a huge roadblock in your way. I think as these things start to go your way, you know, hopefully the public discourse will start to welcome you more. I think, you know, you do a fantastic job. I think it takes a tremendous amount of courage to even ask these questions. I think there's a very good chance that, you know, history may hold you up as you know, a hero if some of these questions that you're seeking answers to come back with answers more so than we've been told. And what I hope is that going forward, if these things do swing your way, that you'll come back and you'll speak to us and you'll speak to my listeners and update us and not forget about us when ultimately you know if you're proven to be accurate.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. If every one of your listeners, in fact, went to YouTube and put a message to Joe Rogan right now, he would have us on, because he's promised to have us on.
But
he never followed through on it. And so, you know, he needs pressure, just like C-SPAN needed a lot of pressure to finally get us on. And it became the number one watched video on their entire website. So that kind of pressure works, and it works on Congress too, which is why we never give up going back to Congress. It's just a matter of the timing, which we can't control. You know, God is really the one in control of the revelation of these, but God works through us, those of us who care enough to make change in our society and get the truth out.
Well, I think that that's immense, because again, that was the first thing I thought of when I thought of going to get you to do the podcast, which is if he hasn't done Joe Rogan, I don't know what the hell he's going to do my podcast for. So to hear that they have promised to have you on and have not, I want to just echo and use my megaphone here, my tiny megaphone that I have, to tell my listeners to blow Joe Rogan's shit up and let him know that you want Richard Gage to appear on his episode. I think it could be one of the most important podcasts possibly in history. And I'm stunned to hear that he's said that he's going to have you on, and he hasn't yet, because I feel like you're right up his alley.
Yeah, I think we could do him a lot of favor and a lot of harm. You know, he's walking a thin line, only dabbling in conspiracies. What I mean by that is truth issues, truth movement issues. He dabbles in, he brings on more skeptics of truth movement issues. And I mean a whole range of rabbit holes, right, which are serious problems in our society that he only plays with, because it seems like the audience is too tame for truth.
Well, you're always going to be welcome here, because regardless of, you know, how things pan out, my goal here is to just keep an open mind and to have civil discourse, which you've done. And I just want to say thank you so much for coming on, and I really sincerely hope that you come back on.
Thanks, Chris. Would love to.
All right. Thank you so much, Richard.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, that was Richard Gage of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. If you enjoyed this episode today, please hit me up on my Patreon, show some love, perhaps donate a small recurring sum to keep the podcast going. I have a great 48 hours coming up of podcast content, and I really meant that about Joe Rogan. You know, I used to think that it was, you know, hey, I would love to go on Joe Rogan someday. But speaking to guys like Dave Collum and speaking to guys like Richard Gage, it's so much more important for me to get these guys that megaphone. And I think they would be fucking awesome guests for Rogan. And so before, I know some of you guys, oh, we got to get you on Joe Rogan. Before you try to do that, get a guy like Richard Gage on there, because that's the type of shit that people need to hear through his megaphone. Regardless, thank you so much to those who have supported me through Patreon and my GoFundMe. The links are in my podcast description. I appreciate my listeners very much, and sincerely, I hope you guys have a great weekend. Peace.